It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and kpecc.org. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, and I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Charles Solomon, critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with the Netflix streaming Polish thriller, The Hater. The film is directed by Jan Komasa, and Christy's going to start us off on The Hater.
I am, and I was just blown away by this, so I'm happy we get a chance to talk about it today. This comes from the director and the writer of Corpus Christi, which was nominated for a Foreign Language Academy Award this past year. And it could not be more relevant on a couple of different levels. It's about this young man who he's getting kicked out of law school at the beginning of the film, and he insinuates himself in the world of both social media, marketing, and politics, and in the dark world of them both. And he's like a straight up sociopath. I mean, he seems mild-mannered and intelligent and nice enough, but it is absolutely chilling to watch him become whoever he needs to be in whatever situation he's in order to manipulate everybody around him to achieve his ends. And I'm not sure he even knows what his ends are. He's just trying to control everybody through fake social media accounts and staging fake protests. All of this is going on as a wave of white nationalism is sweeping across Poland. This film actually was supposed to come out last year and had to be delayed because a violent act that takes place in the movie actually happened in real life. It just happened to be that eerily prescient and relevant. So it's very dramatic and very intense, but the director, Jan Komasa, takes this like detached, almost clinical and cool approach to these increasingly horrific things that are going on. It is so suspenseful.
We're talking about The Hater, Polish thriller, Tim.
Yeah, he's a sort of talented Mr. Ripley-style sociopath, this guy. Even as he's being kicked out of law school, he manages to turn it to his own by asking for the autograph of the professor who's on the panel who's kicking him out of law school. He asks her to autograph her law book for him because she's such a wonderful professor. And he has this sort of dastardly smile. What's interesting is that it needn't be that kind of a sociopath in this particular role. It could be a standard sort of deviant troll, a sort of generally amoral person, or some sort of fifth column. They can do all of the things that this guy did to get the results, a sort of there's this horrible event that he manipulates into happening. And that's what's really chilling about this, is you don't really need that sociopath at the center of these sort of manipulations in order to make these sorts of things happen. And I think that's what got to me the most. He's a wonderful actor. I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name, but he has a way of contorting his face, the looks that he can give that tell the story behind his eyes, that sort of reveal the sort of human being that he is if you're really paying close attention.
The Hater is streaming on Netflix from the Oscar-nominated director of the previous film, Corpus Christi, Jan Komasa. His movie, The Hater, unrated, streaming on Netflix. The ACLU-focused documentary, The Fight, is directed by Elise Steinberg, Josh Kriegman, and Eli Dupre. Tim?
Yeah, all of these legal battles, fights, as it were, are between the ACLU and the Trump administration. It happens to turn out to be that way. The nature of the ACLU itself, though, its sort of driving intention is explored, even when it puts them on the unpopular side of an issue. So whether it's the Klan marching in Skokie, Illinois back in 78, I literally remember that. I was living in the Midwest then, or white nationalists protesting in Charlottesville, Virginia in August of 2017, where young Miss Heather Heyer was killed, the ACLU was on their side of that too. So at the end of the day, though, this is more or less the ACLU against the Trump administration with respect to these particular four things. We follow these four lawyers from the ACLU. Regarding a case regarding abortion rights, the other immigration rights, the other LGBTQ rights, the other voting rights. The arguments in front of the Supreme Court, as we are with these lawyers, more or less flies on the wall. And of course, we know how these cases turned out, and that's all revealed in the film, too. Nevertheless, it's a fairly thrilling and gut-wrenching examination of how these things work.
The Fight documentary focused on the ACLU. One of the attorneys whose profile, by the way, has been a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, Lee Gelernt. Christy, what'd you think of The Fight?
I liked it very much as well, and not unlike the last film we just talked about, The Hater, this could not be more relevant because all this stuff is still happening all around us all the time in terms of, you know, fighting for these kids who are being held in cages, in terms of, you know, the ability for young women to get abortions. Everything that we're seeing take place in this film is still happening every day all around us. And I was sort of impressed with the filmmaker's ability to be everywhere all the time at once. Tim says that they're like flies on the wall, and it's true. This is from the directors of the Anthony Weiner documentary. So this is definitely a world that they are interested in exploring, you know, politics. But the one of the four fights that seems the driest, the one over the citizenship question on the census, you know, are you a U.S. citizen? It would seem to be the most boring and the least emotional, and it ends up being the most emotional and the most gripping of them all just because of the way that it turns out. So, yeah, this is very informative. It's not an eat your vegetables thing at all. It is shot and cut and edited very thrillingly, and you really come to care about and appreciate the hard work that these folks put in.
The Fight is rated PG-13, and it's on a wide range of on-demand platforms. The comedic thriller She Dies Tomorrow is written and directed by Amy Simetz. It stars Caitlin Scheel and Jane Addams. Christy.
Amy Simetz is so great, and she has been around for a while now as an actress, a very beloved indie actress, and increasingly has been behind the camera, writing, producing, directing. And she's got such a clear focus on the tone she wants to set and the kind of story that she wants to tell. Once again, this is a movie that feels very relevant because it's all about existential dread. It's about people who are completely convinced that they are going to die tomorrow. And that notion gets passed on from one person to the next, and it's contagious. It is literally contagious. One person will say, you know, I'm going to die tomorrow. And she's totally convinced of it. And her friends will say, no, you're not. You're just in a bad mood. Here, have a drink. You're fine. And then the idea gets into their head. And again, Amy Simetz made this movie, you know, a while ago, but the feeling of isolation and the feeling of uncertainty that we are all experiencing now, she portrays in her film. And it is a nightmare scenario, but the way that she has shot it in terms of lighting, in terms of color, makes it feel like a dream. There's like a hallucinatory kind of quality to segments of the film that keep you off kilter and not knowing what is real, what's imagined, what's happening in real life, and what's just in your mind, what's a flashback, and what actually happened. You mentioned that it's a comedy. It is unexpectedly funny here and there. There are some like understated, dark comedic moments. But this is a gripping and very tight little horror movie.
She Dies Tomorrow's rated R, written and directed by Amy Simetz. And you can see it on screen at the Mission Tiki Drive-In Montclair and the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. The documentary Rebuilding Paradise is directed by Oscar winner Ron Howard. It takes us back to that awful day, November of 2018, when a fire burning through the mountain town of Paradise in Northern California devastated almost the entire town and disrupted and destroyed the lives of thousands of people. The documentary is showing on demand, as well as at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. Christy, what did you think of Rebuilding Paradise?
It's just gripping, and I don't know how Ron Howard did a lot of what he did here. Maybe you can enlighten us when we hear your interview with him later on, Larry. But I wonder, how did he get this footage? How did he get these folks who live in this town to share these intimate moments of just abject fear? The first 10 minutes of this film, my heart was racing. My heart was pounding, and I was panting because you are in the car with people as they are escaping the flames. It is 11 o'clock in the morning, and it looks like this hellscape in the middle of the night. It must have been terrifying. But so many of these folks, I mean, were willing to share these most intimate moments of fear for this film. And it is terrifying, but also inspiring and also fascinating the way the aftermath plays out in different ways. This is such an insular place. It's such a tight-knit place, the kind of town where you grow up there and then maybe you go off to college at Chico State, which isn't too far away, but then you come back and you want to raise your family there and then pass that on to the next generation. And so, you know, they rebuilt in ways that are inspiring, but you also see how the toll of this broke some families apart, and it's very unexpected, the various paths that we go down with a lot of these people. It's very inspiring. I really enjoyed it.
Rebuilding Paradise, the documentary about what was the deadliest fire in California history. Charles?
Well, I agree with Christy, particularly about the opening of the film. It is so powerful and so frightening, and you wonder, where did he find this footage? How did he get it? It doesn't look like amateur work at all, as the flames are engulfing the car the camera was in. After the fire, though, I think the film rambles a bit, that it doesn't stay as focused. But I did like that it did talk a great deal about how this kind of fire is going to become increasingly common because of climate change. And we have to be prepared for it. We have to find ways to deal with it. So a strong film, but as I say, I felt it was rambling as it went on.
Rebuilding Paradise, Tim.
Yeah, 100-year-old Gold Rush Community Paradise was that first 10 minutes. You're absolutely right. Intrepid, thrilling. Mostly we're seeing random video footage that people capture today, phone cameras, car cameras, a security camera type stuff. Astounding to me that so many people were shooting with their phones right out of their car windows as they were encircled by these torrential flames, children crying and screaming, are we going to die? Yet the camera still rolls. That's an interesting thing that's come to be in our society today. Post-fire, I think Charles is right. We get into sort of issues around rebuilding, PG&E and their responsibility. Should we be building in any of these places at all? I have to say that this was a pretty homogeneous community, Paradise. I did not see a single, and please correct me, Christy and Charles, a single brown or black person in this entire film.
A couple
film.
Of there's Latinos among the college students, yeah. Our high school students,
you.
Excuse me.
I
didn't see a single African American, though.
Very, very homogeneous community. It's interesting. I asked myself as I watched, does this matter? Is it relevant? And I think that there is, in a certain way. We mostly bend over backwards to rebuild these communities. In the Midwest, where I came from, it was always a matter of flooding in the Missouri and Mississippi River basins. They would flood every year. They would rebuild every year. This never happened in black communities. I want to point people to Katrina in the Ninth Ward. Still not rebuilt. So I don't know. I don't know if that's a thing that matters in and of itself, but it does reflect something that goes on in communities of different shapes and colors. And the film doesn't really speak to that very much.
Rebuilding Paradise from director Ron Howard, documentary on the devastating Paradise Fire in the fall of 2018. Ron Howard will be with me later this hour on Film Week talking about the movie. And one way that I think he probably got the cooperation of residents, his mother-in-law lived in Paradise, so he had visited the town previously, which probably helped a bit with entree with the residents. Rebuilding Paradise, rated PG-13 at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and also available on video on demand platforms. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Summerland, which is a British drama starring Gemma Arterton and Gugu Mbatha-Raw. We'll also hear about the documentary on LA's own band, The Go-Go's, which goes back to look at their 1980s height of fame and what's happened to the group afterwards as well. That's a Showtime channel documentary. And the Japanese animated film Ride Your Wave from Masaki Yuasa. Charles Solomon will tell us about that. Those all coming up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC, kpcc.org, and the KPCC app. You know that sound of LA's own Go-Go's? And we're going to hear about a documentary airing on Showtime that highlights the Go-Go's' rise to fame and their tour, the group coming back together, and much more. That coming right up on Film Week with our critics, Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Tim Cogshell. But first, we hear about the British drama Summerlin, starring Gemma Arterton, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and Lucas Bond. Jessica Swale, the writer and director. Tim?
The British always seem to be able to find a new and interesting angle on stories from the Second World War. Miss Whale has found one here, to my mind anyway. She's a noted playwright, by the way. Did a wonderful production of Nell Gwynn that starred Gemma in it, and that's how they sort of got together. Gemma's company produces this film, which is about this woman, a writer, who's living near Dover. And during the war, they were sending children out to the countryside to get them away from London, from the bombing in London. And a boy arrives on her doorstep who she is intended to take care of. She does not want to take care of this boy. She likes living alone. She doesn't pretty much like anybody. Nobody in the town pretty much likes her. The movie is about how her and this young boy bonds, but it's also about where that boy came from and how he ended up on her doorstep in the first place. I love the way Jessica Swale writes these stories. These are about women who are presently empowered women. These are not women looking to be empowered. They already are. Same thing with that Nell Gwynn story. She was an actress in the 17th century who fell in love with, who King Charles II fell in love with, and to the chagrin of many, because she was a woman who would not be told what to do. That's the same thing that's going on in this story. I found it deeply moving. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is in the film. Lucas Bond plays the little boy. I liked it a lot. What I like a lot about it is that it is an original story from Miss Jessica Swale. It's not based on anything.
Summerlin, the film. What do you think, Christy?
It is quite lovely. And in this lineup of films today, which are just absolutely harrowing, it is a nice, charming, beautiful respite, you know, great period clothes and rolling green hills and those, you know, sharp white cliffs of Dover, as Tim mentioned. Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Gemma Arterton have really lovely chemistry together, you know, at a place at a time where it wasn't really okay to be a gay couple, much less an interracial gay couple. You see these glimmers of their love and you know, what could have been, and it's a very sophisticated, lovely soap opera. There is melodrama. There are twists that occur. You know, they might make you make your breath catch as you see them, but everything is done in such a refined, tasteful way that you have to just appreciate it. There's great care that has gone into the details of the scattered messy items on Gemma Arterton's desk next to her typewriter as she's trying to write. You know, her hair is tied back with a scarf at all times. It's meant to look messy, but it's just so. And there's just great care taken with the glances and the way that Gemma Arterton remembers Gugu Mbatha-Raw. She can't remember her face in its entirety the first time because it's just too much to take. So she remembers like what her hand looked like, and then maybe what the fur of her coat looked like, and maybe what her lips looked like. And then finally she can bear to remember the glory of Gugu Mbatha-Raw in full. So yeah, it's very lovely. It's kind of a take your mom movie, you know, it's tasteful, but worth seeing.
Summerlin, British drama, written and directed by Jessica Swale. It's rated PG. It's on screen at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry and on multiple on-demand platforms. The documentary The Go-Go's is from Showtime. It's directed by Allison Elwood. Christy.
So I have to say from the very start that I'm completely the target audience for this. I love the Go-Go's. I always have. Beauty and the Beat is the first album I bought with my own money at Warehouse Records on Ventura Boulevard in Encino. I was 9 years old. I felt very grown up. I remember it like it was yesterday. So I love this band. I love all these songs. And what this film does so well is capture the spirit of them, both back then and now, because it's got this incredible wealth of archival footage and photos from when they were just starting out and punk shows, like great black and white photos of like Jane Wedlin and Belinda Carlisle at punk shows around 79, 80. And that's where the band was birthed. I mean, you know, the first album had a bit of a punk edge to it, but it was more of a pop album. But you see the origins of that sound and how these five women came together. So you have all of that great stuff and these great early performances of the Go-Go's themselves. But then you have interviews with them now, all five of them now, as well as their original manager and two of the original band members. And they look into the camera and they unearth their regrets and they open their hearts, and there's an honesty and a candor and a straightforwardness that are so disarming that it really allows the film to transcend the kind of, you know, behind the music, rise and fall tropes that you see when a band is going back and talking about its history. All the same things tore this band apart that tear so many bands apart: the booze and the drugs and the pressures and the egos. And ultimately with this, with the Go-Go's, it was a fight over money and credit. And then they all went their own separate ways. So that is fascinating. There feels like there's a piece missing, though, because we go from seeing how acrimonious their split was and how shocking that was given this fantastic, loyal sisterhood they'd formed. And then all of a sudden they're back together again. And they're on the stage at the Whiskey like they always were. And they're working on a song together. And I would like to know what happened in that leap, right? Like, who initiated that reunion? And how awkward was that? And what are they doing now? And how does it feel now? So there's a little piece that's missing there. But there is great love for this band. And if you love the Go-Go's, you will love this movie.
The Go-Go's, the documentary from director Allison Elwood, is on Showtime in its channels this weekend, also streaming on Showtime's app. Ride Your Wave, Japanese animated film from director Masaki Yuasa. Charles?
Well, Yuasa is one of the leaders of the alternate anime movement in Japan, and his films don't look like conventional Japanese animation any more than they look like conventional Western animation. The figures are greatly simplified and elongated. They're almost Egon Schlee-esque. He has a very bold sense of color. And in this case, the film focuses on Hinako, a young woman who is a great surfer, but who feels she's a complete klutz on land. Her skill and her grace in the water attract the attention of Minato, a very motivated firefighter. The two of them quickly fall in love. They strengthen each other. They assure each other. They reassure each other. And after he's killed, she believes she can bring him back to her by singing their favorite song, and he'll appear in a watery surface. Ultimately, she moves on. But what I like about this film so much is that in Hinako, you have a heroine who has talents and strengths and abilities, but also doubts and weaknesses and failings. And I think she's a much more fully realized female character than you get in most Western, certainly in most American animated features recently. So this is a very unusual film, even by anime standards, but a very interesting one.
Ride Your Wave, the film. Tim?
Charming. Perhaps overly so in some ways. Our heroines, all of her mannerisms are fairly traditionally Japanese female mannerisms, what we would think of as such. Yet she stands there in this lanky body and with these round eyes and her little yellow bikini, and she is wholly and completely this Western girl. She's a white girl. And while I found this all, you know, interesting, I just can't help it. And I beg Charles, please, to explain to me the sort of visual dynamic. Even the boyfriend has a sort of Western presentation, although you can tell that he's Japanese. And I'm just not exactly sure what the visual or aesthetic dynamic is that brings us to this. Why does she not look like a Japanese girl, Charles?
Well, the answer is that to the Japanese, she acts Japanese, so they accept her as such. The large eyes indicate sensitivity, not a Western ancestry or ethnicity, and she's simply drawn in this particular way. Things like the eye color and the hair color are largely used just to identify characters because the features are often fairly generic. So because she acts like a Japanese girl, to these audiences, she is.
Christy, what'd you think?
I liked it a lot too. It's very sweet. That song is catchy, you guys. If you hear that song once, you hear it 1,000 times in this movie, and it will be stuck in your head for the rest of the day. But it's very sweet. And yeah, as Charles was saying, it's very different in terms of its look for anime, but it also has some very traditional notions of spirituality that we see in anime films, and the powerful use of, you know, fire and water, those elements, and how they forge this connection between these two characters. Yeah, and she is strong, and she is independent, and she doesn't need to be rescued the way she maybe thinks she needs to be rescued in the beginning. She finds herself. She literally rides her wave, her own wave. And yeah, she's a cool character in general. I liked it.
Ride Your Wave, Japanese animated film, is unrated. It's available on demand platforms starting this coming Tuesday from director Masaki Yuasa. Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison, a very personal project for its writer-director Romany Malco, who also stars in the film with Regina Hall. Tim?
Stars In is the writer, director, and editor. As illustrated by his credit of this film, very personal indeed. Funny for sure, this movie. Romany has created this character. And if you are, a black person from corners of the black community, you will know this guy. This is the guy who goes in and out of prison his entire life for all kinds of ridiculously petty crimes. And he's just the kind of guy who in prison learns a certain sort of philosophy, a certain sort of wisdom that you can only learn in prison. And the wacky thing about this prison philosophy and wisdom, it's often quite true. And he decides when he gets out of prison this time that he's going to become a motivational speaker. And this is the path that he sets himself on. He has this parole officer played by Regina Hall wonderfully. And we're in this sort of faux documentary situation. The student filmmaker decides that she wants to follow him around and see what makes him tick. He has a great deal of exuberance, this guy. He's a positive thinker. When he gets into people's lives and he starts talking to them, he tells them all kinds of stuff that really works out well. But in his life, it's just a flaming mess all the time, Tijuana Jackson.
Tim, I feel like I know this man.
This guy's my cousin. I'm not gonna call him out right now, but he knows who I'm talking about. But there's a certain sort of wisdom that's espoused by this character in this film, and that's what Romany is talking. He's talking about prison culture from the point of view of the incarcerated, from the parolee, and how the world looks at them, and how they look back at the world, and how they do not want to live in the boxes that they've been placed in after having been in jail or in prison. It's really, really funny, most of all, but if you're paying attention, there's some good nuggets in there, too.
Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison, written and directed by Romany Malco, who stars in the film as well. It's unrated, and it's on multiple on-demand platforms. The drama The Big Ugly is written and directed by Scott Wiper, Vinnie Jones, Ron Perlman, and Malcolm McDowell star. Tim.
Yeah, and Leonora Critchlow and Levine Rabin are the two women in this movie, and they're pivotal to what's going on in this movie, so I want to mention their names. Now, this is set in West Virginia oil country, with half of the cast being from London. Nevertheless, this is a fairly straightforward Western, with all the elements of High Noon meets gunfight at the OK Corral, right down to the shootouts. You got Vinnie Jones, who's working for Malcolm McDowell. They're these London mobsters. They come to West Virginia to invest or actually launder some money through this oil field that's being run by Ron Perlman. And they're just a bunch of gangsters, too, in cowboy hats. Something goes wrong between Vinnie Jones' girlfriend, played by Leonora Critchlow, and Ron Perlman's son. Somebody's going to have to pay. And so we have our Western. You know, it's pretty intense. It's interesting that at the beginning of this movie, Ron Perlman's character pulls a Confederate flag off the back of a truck, a bunch of old boys that work for him in the oil field, and he says to them, "Why in the hell would you want to ride around with the flag of the losers on your truck? I'm a winner." This is the Ron Perlman character that says this to these old boys. Very, very interesting politics indeed.
The Big Uglies rated R at the Mission Tiki Drive-In Montclair, Rubidoux Drive-In in Riverside, Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and on video on demand. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and kpecc.org. Coming up, we'll talk with Ron Howard, best known for the dramatic films that he's directed over the many years he's been in the business, but he also has done some documentaries lately, including Rebuilding Paradise, his documentary about the devastating fire that leveled a mountain community in Northern California. That's coming right up.